Welcome to History 605, South Dakota State Historical Society's podcast, where we talk to historians, curators, filmmakers, artists, and authors about how they interpret the past.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt.
I'm Dr. Ben Jones, South Dakota State Historian and Director of the State Historical Society. Join me and our guests as we think historically.
So it is most appropriate and fitting that in our first year of our second century that this should also be a year of reconciliation between the Indian people and the non-Indian people alike.
History 605 is sponsored by the Gruver Family Trust and done in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the show. Welcome to History 605. Today on the show, we have a discussion with Joseph Graves, South Dakota's Secretary of Education. Dr. Graves has been secretary since January of 2022. Prior to that, he served as the superintendent for the Mitchell School District since the year 2000. He earned his bachelor's degree from SDSU, his master's in history from USD, and his education degrees from Drake University. Sir, welcome to History 605.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. It's an interesting topic that you did, and just a brief description that you and some other department staff, I assume, have crafted a set of instructional materials about South Dakota people, places, and animals to have some fun and in a way kind of help foster a sense of resilience in South Dakota's students. I wonder if you can explain what prompted the effort.
Sure. What we've noticed during the pandemic, and actually even prior to the pandemic, I think in part because of smartphones and some other technology, is that we seem to be actively training kids not to be resilient and to be introspective to the point of navel gazing and to not be actors in their own lives, to allow their lives, others to act upon their lives as if they aren't really in charge. And of course, every human being is in charge of their own life. One of the things we talk about is, where's your locus of control? Are you a person who believes your locus of control is external, with everyone acting upon you, or internal, that you are the actor in your life, you're the hero of your own play? And when you do the opposite, and there's some recent studies have been out, even when you talk to people about, say, for example, mental health to a degree, you eventually start to give the impression to people that they have issues with mental health. Rather than dealing with individuals who do have issues, we're trying to kind of inculcate the whole idea that everyone has such issues. And when you start to do therapy on a mass basis, for example, there's Beth Schreier recently put out a book called Bad Therapy, and she talks about iatrogenic causes, or what it really means is, there's a cost to therapy, whether it's therapy for mental health, even if it's physical. If you go to a physician and a physician says, we're going to need to do the following thing, well, everything has side effects. I mean, you can't listen to TV anymore. Every time they talk about a drug, they talk about this endless list of side effects, to the point where you wonder, maybe I should just stick with the illness. So you have these things, and what I think what we're telling kids right now is, oh, there's all these things that are going wrong and all these things you need to be aware of. And rather than telling kids that, hey, you're tough, you're resilient, you can deal with life, we're doing the opposite. And I think what I'm trying to get across, what we're trying to get across as the Department of Education, is, you know, there's a lot of examples out there of people who have conquered life. And a lot of these examples are South Dakotans, or they have a strong South Dakota connection. Mm-hmm. That's what we tried to tap into here. How do we send a message to kids that you are the hero of your own life, that you are strong and you have grit and you are resilient? And how can we teach you that through real life examples and examples that tie back into other instructional areas? So we see this thing being offered by school counselors. School counselors tend to have a real small piece of instructional time for elementary students, for example. And to tie it back into not just those goals or those objectives, or those standards, but also into standards like literacy standards or ELA, social studies standards, even science standards. All these things tap in, and we can give kids a lesson through South Dakotans with multi-levels of standards instruction. That's what we were after.
Okay. Well, that sounds pretty interesting. And I was looking through the website where all these lessons are posted now. You've got them up on the web for about a month, I think, or a few weeks anyway. A
couple weeks.
Yeah. Kind of go through, how did you pick somebody like, Theodore Roosevelt, Crazy Horse, Lauren Ingalls Wilder, Billy Mills? These are interesting people, pretty well-known people. How did you pick the ones you did? And then we can get into the story a little bit about each one, I think.
Picked them in several ways. Number one, we wanted them to have a South Dakota connection so that a South Dakota student can relate to them.
Yeah.
Second, we wanted them to be a person of prominence, someone who accomplished something significant or even great. And third, we wanted them to typify some concept, some principle of resilience. So, for example, Billy Mills, we wanted to talk about, don't prepare the path for yourself, prepare yourself for the path or the road. And it's a very important principle, and kids need to learn it. But it's not necessarily just intuitive. You kind of have to hear it. For some people, it's intuitive. Others, it's not. So we want to give them those examples. And we think that by giving them those examples, they can kind of find their way. Hopefully, most South Dakota students have some adult that's a very positive influence. It's a very powerful influence on their life. But increasingly, there are a lot of kids who don't. Or there's a lot of kids who pursue other people of influence who aren't necessarily positive. We're trying to supplant that. We're trying to substitute those people for somebody who is worth emulating. Now, of course, nothing ever replaces a parent. Nothing ever replaces a grandparent. Sure. These are people on the side that can also help.
Well, I appreciate that comment about Billy Mills and how he prepared for the road. And you've got his story in there. How is that an example? What did he do to prepare for the road?
Billy Mills is interesting. And in fact, he is the one person in this study who's alive.
Yeah.
And
yes, he still is.
Going strong. When we wrote it, we contacted him and said, hey, what do you think? And we sent it to him.
Okay.
And he made some edits for us. Well, what we noticed was he goes through his life as a young person. He loses his parents. He has an opportunity to go to college down in Nebraska. And throughout his high school career and his college career, he's running track. He's also doing some boxing and some other things, but he's running track. He's running cross country. He's doing those kinds of things. And interestingly, the first time Billy Mills owned a new pair of track shoes was the night before he ran his Olympics race.
Wow.
This is stunning. If you talk to kids today, what's the first thing people do? They go out and buy all the very best equipment, all the most stunning, expensive, you know.
Yeah.
I had a son in tennis, and he said, I need to get a tennis racket. I said, okay, so let's go get your tennis racket. I was expecting the racket that I used to play with, which was the steel racket, which replaced those old wooden jobs. I had no idea that the tennis racket he would be using. Those things are space age.
Right.
Everybody's got to have those things now, and everybody's got to have the best equipment. Here's the guy, the only modern American who's won that race, and he did it basically with no decent equipment. And really, for the most part, he didn't really even have a place to practice on except when he got to college.
Right. Yeah, so he's down there in Kansas and going to KU, and his coach offers him this opportunity. But that's amazing that he gets to the Olympics with really no decent equipment. And that in and of itself, I think, is a hallmark of a lot of people who go through adversity, is the adversity itself trains them up and makes them stronger. I guess that would be the point with about
the other thing
matching
I love
yourself
about Billy
to the
Mills
road.
Is he was completely set aside as a serious contender in that race. Nobody believed. There were three people they felt could maybe win this race. And when Billy Mills came around, if you hear that video, and you should, it's worth listening. I listened to it, and it's one of those videos where you know what's going to happen because he's got to win the race, right? But you tense up. You go, wow, can he really do this? It's silly. And so it was such an incredible thing that the announcer kind of loses track of it. He starts to scream to the point where it was considered unprofessional, and the guy lost his job.
Oh, no.
Yeah, because of the way he reacted to it, which today it's absolutely normal the way he reacted to it. Anyway, that's the report I was reading in the story on that. It was just such a stunning victory that nobody expected it.
There's a couple people on here that are, well, they're not people, for one thing. Before we talk about the non-people, I guess a person that I was pleased to see but hadn't expected was Frank Baum, the author of The Wizard of Oz. How did you, what drew you to pick him?
Well, L. Frank Baum had an interesting life, and of course, he only spent a brief time up in Aberdeen. He tried to run a general store. He tried to run a newspaper. Didn't work out for him. He tried to be an actor. He tried to be someone who wrote plays. And he finally writes, of course, and by the way, there's many, many, many Wizard of Oz books. We all tend to focus on the first one, but there's multiple if you start looking.
Okay.
He writes that one book, and he himself admits that most of the characters that came out of that were characters from South Dakota, from Aberdeen, that he then writes into this story, and then that's it. He faces life financially. He struggles his whole life up until he starts writing those books. But he never gives up. He constantly is writing and writing and writing and trying and trying and trying. And he overcomes all those things. Again, the connection to South Dakota is brief, but extremely mm-hmm. powerful.
He came during territorial days and left just after statehood. And the economy's rough. The grasshoppers are eating crops. And there's a lot of people who couldn't make it and left in the 1890s. And I guess he was one of them. When you watch that movie now, the notion that, you know, we're going to travel to see the Wizard of Oz and he's going to give us what we need. And then, of course, the ending is, well, as the kids would say today, he flips the script on him, right? The Wizard of Oz, or in the movie version, he doesn't provide anything for them that they don't already have, as the song goes, right? I think you make that point in there, and that's very insightful what that story can provide kids. I think that they have what they need with some guidance and some support and some help and some encouragement, certainly, but they've got their strength inside them. They just need to find it. I think that's the point of this whole project to some degree, isn't it?
It is, and thank you for that. That when they're standing before the wizard and the wizard's admitting basically that he's a fraud, it's fantastic. And he says, you already have this. The cowardly lion, you already fought the guards, you already fought off the monkeys and everything else, and you are courageous. You just how he missed it is hard to say. And of course, and Aberdeen, by the way, has, you know, very much tapped into this. They have a beautiful facility up there that's all based upon, in large part, at least in sections of it, upon the Wizard of Oz.
Also, a non-human in this is the Corn Palace. I love the hook you give a lot of these stories and how to begin that. You're spent many years living in Mitchell, so you're very familiar mm-hmm. with the Corn Palace. But what's the story there for South Dakota Sturdy?
I love that old song. It's a grand old flag, and the grand old flag there's a statement in there about America being a place where there's never a boast or brag, and that's what the Corn Palace is about. The Corn Palace was put up because there was a deep feeling in America that the Great Plains were essentially America's desert. It was never going to be productive. Mm-hmm. It should just be skipped over, head to California and leave the rest. And of course, then people went back and started to farm, and it was successful. Now, of course, it's America's breadbasket. And the great thing about the Corn Palaces was they were advertising. By sticking corn and other crops on the walls, it became this tourist attraction. It was extremely phenomenal. And by the way, there were many corn palaces. There were grain palaces. I think Aberdeen had a grain palace. And the only reason that we can say, they can say in Mitchell, world's only corn palace, is because everybody else gave it up. Everybody else, it had its day, and then they went on and they moved past it. But Mitchell held on, and they have that. But the great thing about the people of Mitchell is when you talk about the Corn Palace to them, they kind of smile. I had to bring some professors in to a lecture to a group of American history teachers that I was working with at one time. Invariably, they'd say, well, we'd be talking about where you're from. I'm from Mitchell, South Dakota. And they always say, you know, I've been to Mitchell. And then they'd kind of lift their eyes to the air, trying to figure it out. And I would always say, "Yeah, you visited the Corn Palace." And they'd say, "Yeah, that's it. I did visit the Corn Palace." And the Corn Palace is something you go visit oftentimes just once. And the
right.
people in Mitchell don't take the Corn Palace all that seriously.
Right.
They call it the world's largest bird feeder. it's not just for birds, it's also for squirrels. But we all smile because it brings in hundreds of thousands of people every year to see the Corn Palace. It's not a great work of art. We call it folk art.
Mm-hmm.
It's not some incredible architectural innovation. No, we stuck corn to the walls and we made it into patterns, which are kind of cool. But Mitchell doesn't take it all that seriously. It doesn't boast or brag about it. I love that about South Dakotans. They do the job, they get the job done, and then they don't talk all that much about it. They don't
right.
have to brag as an adult. Your goal, one of the things, your goal in life about what your job is you want to underpromise and overdeliver. Not the opposite, but so much in our society today is always bragging before you've ever done anything. And what I love about South Dakotans is they don't brag even after they have done something.
That's a good transition to somebody I wanted to talk about is Joe Foss is reportedly has said, it ain't bragging if you done it, but if you done it, doesn't mean you have to brag about it. I don't think that quote's in your South Dakota Sturdy story, but how did Joe Foss get selected? And wonder if you can share a little bit about the story that you tell about Captain Joe Foss.
Joe Foss grew up in a little community outside of Sioux Falls. He got to a certain age and he was in school and his father died. And it was a difficult time, and so he quit his job, and he became the man of the house, and he took jobs, supported his mom, the rest of the family, and did those kinds of things. And then when he had an opportunity to do so, he actually returned to school. He finishes high school way past a normal age, so he's way too old to be graduating from high school, simply because it was available to him. And I'll tell you right now, as a former superintendent, when a kid gets past the age of 18, they never want to go back to high school if they haven't already graduated, because they're embarrassed. Well, it had to embarrass Joe Foss a bit to be a 21-year-old in high school, but he did, and he went back and he got his education. And then he gets in, you know, he gets into the military, does all these other things, and he actually goes back for college too. And he's
right.
graduating college way too old
mm-hmm.
for age. But he never gives that stuff up. And he as you know, and you told me this story originally, when he's in the military, he's taken some really wild chances. In one case, he's disobeying direct orders to make things happen and to become this World War II flying ace of the Pacific theater. But in all of that, he never does really brag about it. He never really does those kinds of things. And he never lets something that might be a bit embarrassing get in his way of doing something important.
Yeah, he certainly. And the smattering of stuff he does across the life, from aviation to politics, becomes South Dakota's governor, to being the first commissioner of the upstart American Football League,
mm-hmm.
which is now the merged with the NFL mm-hmm. in 1969-70 timeframe, and then going on to found these hunting shows, which now you can turn up and down the internet and see all kinds of things that are, in many cases, patterned after a Joe Foss wildlife show. One more take, Crazy Horse. Interesting choice and a good one, I think. How does Crazy Horse exemplify some of the things you wanted to communicate here?
You know, when I was studying Crazy Horse, the thing I was struck by right off the hand was there really isn't a known portrait of him. There's people who think maybe they have a portrait of him, but nobody's sure. It's like he's this person who kind of stands back. He leads incredibly strongly in many ways. He was a consummate Lakota warrior, and that was an important concept. It is an important concept in that culture today and then. And he was incredibly gifted and skilled at it. I mean, many, and I think they're correct, believe that Custer might have been able to escape from that battle and from his end had not Crazy Horse cut him off. But Crazy Horse could see what was going on, and he takes his warriors up, and they block him in that area. But he learned early on, Crazy Horse, that his job, while it was important to be the warrior, was fundamentally to take care of his people, to take care especially of the people who were unable to take care of themselves in the situation they were in. So he felt very strongly that his responsibility were to the elderly in his groups, to the children in his group, and in many cases, the women in his group. And so he had this obligation, and it must have been just incredibly painful for him to have finally had to relent, to had to abandon the battlefield and go into the fort, and not so much as surrender, but simply march in with the people.
Right.
Because had he not done so, his people would have starved. At one point, it would have been very easy for, there's a little bit of an analogous to Robert E. Lee. When Lee got to the end and he could see that things were coming to an end, many of his fellow soldiers encouraged him, let's go up in the mountains and let's become guerrillas. Let's continue this fight in that manner.
Right.
And Lee said, no, we're not going to do that. A war needs to end. He did that. And it was the best thing for everybody involved, including the Southerners. Well, Crazy Horse wants to go off, take a few of his chief warriors, go out, harass the incursions of the European settlers and make that happen and live the life of a true Lakota warrior. But he looks back and he says, no, I've got to take care of my people. And in he goes. And so he remembers that fundamental thing, which is you have to take care of those who are unable to take care of themselves. And it's really quite an interesting story all the way up until his untimely death.
He's sticking true to his sole purpose, I guess you would say, or his main purpose. So we don't need to go over all of them. I think, though, how are you expecting these to be used in the classroom or in schools? What's your hope and what's your design for that?
Truthfully, we're more than happy to have them used by anybody in a school at any grade level. We designed them for about grades 4 through 6.
Okay.
And the idea was that the guidance curriculum, many schools, most schools have a school counselor. And those school counselors will oftentimes teach a special at the elementary level.
Mm-hmm.
Now, specials include music, art, and oftentimes guidance or school counseling position.
Yeah.
So the school counselor comes in there, and in part it's because you kind of have a section of the day. It might last half an hour, might be a little bit longer, where you offer an art class. And then that may be on Monday and Wednesday. And on Tuesday and Thursday, you're offering, say, music, or you're offering PE. And there's always that one extra day. And frequently, that's the guidance curriculum. That's when that's taught. And there are standards for that curriculum as well. What we saw was those standards could be taught very ably through the South Dakota Sturdy. So
okay.
We are focusing on them. It doesn't have to be them, because we've also talked about sixth grade teacher being offered to their class, or an elementary classroom teacher being able to offer it. But that school counselor walks into that session of a guidance session and pulls this out. And now she's got a lesson in which the students are reading. So now we're doubling up our instructional time. People think the school day is kind of a long day, but in truth, it's not. A school day is about 7 hours long. And then at elementary level, and sometimes even at sixth grade, you got to take out the recesses. So morning recess, evening, afternoon recess, got that recess during the lunch period, take out the lunch period. An instructional day at that level is actually not 7 hours. It's about 5.5 hours, which is just not enough time with 175 school days per year and 13 years of school. It's not enough time to teach everything we need to teach him. So the clever teacher, the effective teacher, doubles up and says, how can I teach both reading and something else? So we put a lot of reading into that. So that's all those narratives over all these different individuals and
right.
animals, and in one case, a building. And so the students are now going to be spending time reading during the guidance. And also, many of those standards are also social studies standards. And they're also, even in some cases, science standards. So we've got science standards we included with the item on the ringneck pheasant and on the American buffalo.
Yeah, it's economizing the time you have to do double, maybe triple duty. That's great. One last, maybe a story to close out on is General Beadle. Not somebody who's super well known anymore, unfortunately. Why did you pick him?
I picked General Beadle because I love General Beadle. General Beadle focuses. There's a wonderful old story about a Roman senator, Cato, who is very incensed by the fact that Rome's traditional enemy, nemesis even, city-state, is still there, Carthage. And there were three wars fought against Carthage, called the Punic Wars. This, after the second one, Carthage had been roundly defeated, but there was always a fear they'd come back. And so Cato, when he's speaking to the Roman Senate, he would always end every speech, whether it was about the Roman aqueducts or about the dole or about some one of their many gods, no matter what the topic was, he would end with a statement, "Oh, and Carthage must be destroyed." And he gets his way. When they finally do decide, yeah, we better go destroy him. They level the place and they salt the ground so nothing can ever live there again. But the point is, that probably wouldn't have happened except he focused. He set a priority and said, we're going to go after this. That's what General Beadle did. General Beadle is this fascinating character because he's a general in the Civil War. Those guys, you know, when they got down to the Civil War, they had filled their bucket list. They had done, saved the world, they had freed the slaves. I mean, they don't need to do anything else. General Beadle comes back out, he goes in, and what he focuses on is the public school lands.
Why is that an issue, public school lands?
It's an issue because the public school lands in most other states up to that point had been sold off at a very cheap amount of money. And then the amount of money deposited in the treasury and spent. As a result, there was nothing left of the public school. They had been sold off and that there were no more resources for it. General Beadle could see that that was a mistake. So what he said was, you can only send the public school, sell the public school lands at market value, not this cheap value, and you may keep it and you need to invest it and it needs to go year after year with a small percentage of it then being a revenue stream for schools, but always protecting that principal and growing that principal. Mm-hmm. And he went all over the state. As you know, he was the one of the territorial secretaries of education. He has statues over the Capitol. Whenever I go out to the Capitol and I think about it, I always go over and when nobody's looking, I reach my hand down and I touch his foot because it's good luck, which is pure hokum and pure superstition, but that's me. And he's the one who saved the school land. So tens of millions of dollars every year go out to the public schools in South Dakota because this guy, back in the 19th century, made it this huge priority and he focused and he would never let anybody forget about it. As a result, the language he got put into the South Dakota Constitution mm-hmm. also became the language in about five or six other state constitutions in the country to the point where Congress would not admit a state unless it had General Beadle's language in on the public school lands.
Right.
Because he focused. And that's the power of just setting a priority and pursuing it doggedly. It's amazing.
I've read some of the debates and the words back and forth between the members of the South Dakota Constitutional Convention as they're trying to figure out, well, should we do this at all? This putting in this part of the Constitution that would protect the school lands. And if we do, what's the price? And you can kind of tell there's a whole lot of interests and other things besides education that's, you know, in the background of their argument. They're trying to sort out, should it be $10? Should the things be public or not? How fair is that? Maybe the price should be less, you know, West River, the price should be less and so forth. And he and his colleagues stick to their guns the whole time through all kinds of, I'm sure, insults and probably a few dirty tricks and all of that. And he certainly gets a lot of, I guess, what today people call the eye roll. Oh, this guy's talking about the school lands again. But in the end, it still spins off a check every year, doesn't it?
It does. And, you know, the other thing is on a personal level and on a personal level for you, too, I would assume, since you've been Secretary of Education, too. General Beadle is just this great role model. Yeah, and he's a role model for this specific job. So how can you beat that?
That's right. How can you beat it? Well, Secretary Graves, thanks so much for joining us. We'll put a link to South Dakota Sturdy in the show notes. And also, if somebody wants to go and check it out, they can look at, they can type in doe.sd.gov/sdsturdy to check out the lesson plans and the guidance and the lessons for South Dakota's kids or kids wherever you might be from, I think could benefit from this. Thanks a lot for being on History 605. I've enjoyed the conversation, and I hope this turns out to be something very useful.
Dr. Jones, thank you so much for having me on.
We'd like to thank Howard and Dorothy Gruver for their passion for history and the support of the South Dakota State Historical Society. It's through gifts such as theirs that we're able to tell South Dakota's history.
When a tornado hits a town, I've never been able to figure out which houses were the Democrats or the Republicans or the Libertarians. I never knew who the Norwegians were, the Swedes, or the Czechoslovakians, or the Germans. Of course, everybody wants to point out who the Irish are, but other than that...
History 605 is produced by the South Dakota State Historical Society, and its audio engineer is the amazing Kevin Larson. We'd like to thank our partner, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, we'd like to thank you for listening. Please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode of History 605.